I'm vice chair of the Chesapeake Legal Alliance. We provide free legal services on cases relating to the restoration and preservation of the Chesapeake Bay and its six-state watershed. Back in the mid-70s, I was at EPA, and then in 1979, I was a founding partner with a law firm called Kroll & Mooring. Tom Lovejoy, immediately on my left, your right, is a pioneer in conservation biology. He is professor of environmental science and policy at George Mason University. He holds the biodiversity chair at the Heinz Center for Science, Economics, and the Environment. He coined the term biological diversity, which most of you are familiar with now. And for the past 25 years, he's done pathbreaking work on the interrelationship between climate change and biodiversity, including impacts on the ocean. Last year, Tom received the Blue Planet Prize awarded in Tokyo, and this is really widely regarded as the highest international award for environmental work. Bill Nordhaus is the economic expert on our panel. He's a Sterling Professor of Economics right here at Yale. He is a member of the National Academy of Sciences and a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. From 1977 to 79, he was a member of the President's Council on Economic Advisors. And from 1986 to 88, he was Yale's provost. He's currently, among other things, deputy chair of the board of directors of the Federal Reserve Bank up in Boston. Ian Robertson, the far end, is a land developer with a green streak. He's done a lot of projects involving sustainable development, for which he has been equally ridiculed by the business community and the environmental community as a wild dreamer. He's founder and chairman of Sundance Homes, a former chairman of Sustaining Home Builders in Greater Chicago. And today he's a director at the Kohala Center, which is a nonprofit community-based center out in Hawaii for environmental conservation. Now, I want to begin with a few key facts just to frame our discussion. First of all, in our lifetimes, the population on this globe has tripled. As a result of that and some bad habits, we are consuming our natural resources at a far greater rate than their ability to sustain human life as we know it. In a nutshell, we've experienced major glacier melting. You've seen these kinds of problems. We're overfishing our seas. We're over-harvesting our forests. We are polluting our air and water. We're causing severe climate disruption through the emission of greenhouse gases. And let's take a look at a couple of specifics along those lines. First of all, since the beginning of the last century, over half the world's forests have been destroyed. And those trees are disappearing at the rate of an acre a second. More than half our wetlands are gone. And as many of you know, those wetlands are critically important. They're the habitat right at the base of the food chain for aquatic organisms. We've seriously overfished our oceans. 90% of the large fish that were present a century ago are now gone. We're exhausting our drinking water supplies both here and globally. Poor land use has resulted in major losses of farmland at precisely the time when we need more farmland to feed this growing population. We dump so much pollution into the Mississippi River that each year a dead zone is created off in the Gulf of Mexico the size of the state of New Jersey where no fish can live. As a result of all of this, you can see the destruction to the planet, and it's got to be turned around. Just a word about climate change. Since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the concentration of heat-trapping greenhouse gases, mainly carbon dioxide, in our atmosphere has increased 30% after having been stable for many thousands of years. This has resulted mainly from human activity, burning fossil fuels, namely coal in our power plants and oil in the gasoline we burn in our cars. The results are well known to all of you. Sea level rise, major glacier melting, more violent weather conditions, ocean acidification, and changes in bird and insect migration and vegetation patterns. And those happen more in some parts of the world than others. Some of you may not be close to places where those kinds of things are happening. But, for example, in the western United States and Canada over the last several years, because of increases in temperature, Bark beetles have moved further north into areas that they've never been before, and they have destroyed thousands of acres of trees. They never visited those areas before, so the trees had no resistance. Reducing these emissions will not be easy or cheap. Renewable energy will take time. But the point is, if we don't make some major changes, we're simply going to destroy the ability of our ecosystem to sustain human life. Equally troubling is the fact that our political leaders don't seem to be discussing these issues, perhaps because we as people haven't been doing enough to make them discuss them. But the questions we want to tee up with you today is, what can we as individuals do about this? What should we as a nation be doing about this? We're going to have three presentations followed by the Q&A, and just to tell you what each of them are going to cover, Tom is going to lead off with a discussion on ocean acidification with a tie-in to greenhouse gas releases. Bill is going to discuss alternative strategies to reduce carbon emissions, and then Ian's going to discuss conservation issues, including smart land use and green building design. So, Tom, take us to the ocean.
So, as Ridge has emphasized, this session is not just about the problems, it's about things you can do. I'm going to give a slightly broader picture than ocean acidification, but in the end show how the biology of the planet can actually contribute to reducing the impact of climate change. So, one of the most useful constructs in recent years to think about environmental issues is this diagram of planetary boundaries. We won't spend a lot of time on it. The one on the right shows how the nitrogen cycle has been distorted. Double natural levels of biologically active nitrogen available around the world, that creating dead zones like Ridge just mentioned. At the top, climate change looks like the smallest. I think, in fact, it is underestimated. Because of the impact on biological diversity. And then on the left, biodiversity loss is the largest. And it's the largest simply because anything that is an environmental problem affects living systems. So biodiversity actually integrates all the ways we impact the environment. So in 1897, when Swedish scientist Arrhenius published his famous paper, he was actually asking the question, why is the Earth a habitable temperature for humans and other forms of life? Why is it not too cold? And the answer was the greenhouse effect, the natural greenhouse effect, which we're now distorting. What he did not know was that for the previous 10,000 years, the Earth's climate had in fact been extraordinarily stable, which means that the entire human enterprise is based on the assumption of a stable climate, and also in that 10,000 years, all ecosystems adapted to a stable climate. And of course, that is changing. And in fact, this shows CO2 concentrations over the last 600,000 years. It's out of date. It's now all the way up to 400 parts per million, which was last experienced on Earth 3 million years ago. The Earth's climate system is responding. We're about 0.8 to 0.9 degrees warmer than in pre-industrial times. And if we wanted to stop at 2 degrees, which is an important number to remember, we would have to peak in fossil fuel consumption and emissions in about 2016 to 2020. Pretty daunting. But what are we seeing in terms of the responses of the natural world? We're seeing things around the liquid and solid forms of water, so lakes freezing over later in the fall, ice breaking up earlier in the spring, glaciers retreating in most parts around the world, Tony Knoll's estate is melting. We are seeing sea level rise, about half a meter in the New York area at the moment, and in fact, as was noted at some point, when my great-grandfather chaired the commission that designed the New York subway system, how was he supposed to foresee that three generations later, the sea level would be rising. There is no question about the increase of wildfire in the American West. Basically, we see that in the papers and in the news and in the cyber world every summer. But from here on out, it's going to be about biology. So plants are changing their blooming times, like lilacs blooming earlier in New England. Animals are changing aspects of their annual cycles. So birds are nesting earlier, migrating earlier, laying eggs earlier, and they're changing where they actually occur. So this particular species of butterfly has moved northward and upward in altitude. The Joshua trees are marching literally out of Joshua Tree National Park. And the National Arbor Day Foundation, which is hardly some extremist, wild-eyed, environmentalist, terrorist organization, but which is all about people who love to plant trees, found it necessary to produce a new hardiness zone map to guide their members on which species they could expect to plant and grow successfully. We're seeing these changes not only on the land, but also in the oceans, and we're seeing really interesting situations where essentially couplings in nature are coming apart because one of the features is dependent on temperature and the other is dependent on day length. So you have snowshoe hares now being found in their white winter fur with backgrounds like they would normally have encountered only in the summer on the right. Makes them much more vulnerable to predation. So this incomprehensible slide, which I would mark down my students if they produced, is actually to make the point that what I'm talking about is no longer just individual examples or anecdotes. It is statistically robust. You can see the fingerprints of climate change on nature almost anywhere in the world. So it's much more important, in fact, to look ahead to what we might be getting ourselves into. So for a well-known species like sugar maple, you can actually project where it would be likely to occur if we doubled the pre-industrial levels of CO2. And basically the answer is anything you like about sugar maples, you will have to go to Canada to enjoy. And this is not going to be just about temperature. It's also going to be about precipitation change. So some of the droughts that we're seeing in particular parts of the world actually do appear tied to climate change. Cold water species will be particularly vulnerable, such as trout. And species which live in high places will be moving upwards like that butterfly, but at a certain pace, a point like these endemic vertebrates from the rainforests of Australia will have no further up to go. So high altitude species are particularly vulnerable, as are species on islands, particularly low level islands, in part because of the sea level issue. And there are complications that we will encounter. So climate change, of course, is not new in the history of life on Earth. Glaciers came and went. But the difference is today, as species try to track their required climate conditions, they're going to be doing it in human-modified landscapes. So basically creating an obstacle course for them as they try to track their required conditions. This is one of the more fixable complications because you can simply work at putting connections, natural connections, back into the landscape. If climate change proceeds a lot further, we run into a different kind of complication, which is that ecosystems don't move as a unit. The individual species move, each at their own rate and in their own direction. So here we're looking at three mammal species, two tree species, and one insect species after the retreat of the last glacier in Europe. You can see there is no common pattern. basically, what it means with greater climate change, we'll reach a point at which ecosystems will disassemble and the species will move, and then the survivors will reassemble into new ecosystems, which are really hard to envision, let alone manage in advance. Third complication, most of the discussion and most of the models treat everything as though it's linear and gradual. We know it does not work that way. We know the climate system does not work that way. And the bark beetle coniferous forest situation that Ridge referred to does not work that way. So in that particular case, it has just tipped the balance in favor of the bark beetles. And in most parts of the North American West, the coniferous forests are something like 70% dead trees. In the oceans, finally to the oceans, this is what coral reefs all look like when we were undergraduates. Wonderful, technicolor, highly diverse, productive, gorgeous ecosystems. And starting in 1983, we began to see events caused by brief periods of warmer water, and basically in which the coral reef ecosystem breaks down and you have what are called bleaching events, and the whole thing basically crashes in diversity and productivity and has serious implications for all the people who depend on them for their well-being. And then finally, we're beginning to see some changes which are even bigger. One of these involves the hydrological cycle of the Amazon basin. And with two major droughts in 2005 and 2010, whether that's caused by climate change and other things is still open to debate, but it is in fact at least a preview of what the climate models are suggesting will happen, of dieback in the southern and eastern Amazon. And the biggest system change so far is in fact in the acidification of the oceans. And that escaped most of us working on these issues. Everybody was happy the oceans were absorbing as much of the excess CO2 as they could, but we forgot our high school chemistry that some of that would actually turn into carbonic acid. So the oceans today are a tenth of a pH unit more acid than in pre-industrial times. Sounds trivial, but that's an exponential scale, so that's 30% more acid, and it has enormous implications for literally tens of thousands of species which build their skeletons and their shells from calcium carbonate, including ones at the base of major food chains, like this wonderful little sea butterfly, teeny little snail, which is at the base of food chains, for example, off of Alaska. So we're seeing effects in oyster beds in the Northwest, for example. So we're really getting at a point where we're fiddling with critical thresholds in the Earth system that we don't know a lot about. So the sensible thing would be to find some way to back off from all of that. So the 2 degree that I talked about earlier is the agreed upon target internationally for where ideally climate change should be limited. But in fact, when you start looking at it, what it really means, that is too much. It's too high. It's bad from an ice point of view, and it's bad from an ecosystem point of view. So the last time the planet was 2 degrees warmer, the oceans were 4 to 6 meters higher. And in a way, you don't need to know anything more than that. We don't know how long it will take us to get there, but we know the end point. So there are those like Jim Hansen and myself who say it would really be a lot better if we could stop at a concentration around 350 parts per million or 1.5 degrees. The problem is we're already pushing beyond that. So if you go beyond that, it's a world without tropical coral reefs. We have the sea level issue. So what can you do about all of that? Well, there's a whole bunch of things you can do in conservation strategies. There are a whole bunch of things you can do around emissions, revising the energy base for society, and reducing and eliminating the emissions from deforestation. So basically, I'm building a case here. We need a systemic solution, which, in fact, Bill will be talking about. So the best-kept secret about all of this is there is a whole chunk of those excess emissions, not from the burning of fossil fuels, but from destruction of forests and degradation of grasslands and agroecosystems which leak carbon. So if you think about it, we have an equation we can play with sources of CO2 from deforestation and burning fossil fuels and going into the atmosphere, land, and the oceans. Is there a way we can play with this equation and maybe even turn one of those arrows around? So if you really think about it, there is a substantial amount of CO2 that could come back out of the atmosphere if we restored some of those ecosystems. And twice in the history of life on Earth, this actually happened. First time was with the arrival of flowering plants on land. The second time was with the arrival of flowering plants. And you can see it was highly effective at doing it. It just took tens of millions of years. Well, we don't have tens of millions of years. But happily, the number about excess CO2 in the atmosphere is big enough that if we really got engaged in reforesting in degraded areas south of the Amazon, for example, and if we really got engaged in restoring degraded grazing lands, which would give us, among other things, better grazing, and if we really got involved in agro ecosystems that accumulate carbon rather than leak them, what you get out of that, in fact, is better soil fertility. So in the end, there's about half a degree that we could pull out by getting into that kind of an exercise. And it's beginning to happen here and there around the world. It's just yet to be at scale. So in the end, I guess what I'm arguing is that the planet works as a physical and biological system coupled together. And if we use the biology of that system by regreening the Emerald Planet, we can, in fact, make the planet more habitable. Thank you very much.
All right, we'll take a minute here to see if we can find out. Okay, so I'm Bill Nordhaus, and I will give you a social science economic perspective on the issue. Part of what's interesting and fascinating about the climate, and I'm going to focus on climate change, part of the fascinating issue is that actually it involves much more than science. It involves many of the things Tom talked about. It involves earth sciences, it involves oceanography and biology, conservation biology, but also it very much involves the social sciences, in particular economics, obviously, because in a way that's where it starts. It starts with burning of fossil fuels, which are driven by economic growth and technology. And then I think what I want to suggest is that if we are going to solve the problem, the solutions will come in the social sciences with economic instruments, political action, and diplomacy. So it's a problem that spans a great deal of our disciplines that we cover at places like Yale. So let me just get started here. Okay. So many of you were here, I hope, for the yesterday afternoon. We had a survey and we had the documentary. So I thought what I'd like to do is I'd like to find out what people think. So I'm going to do a little. Jer Johnson didn't have a survey on this, so let's do a survey here on what the class of 1963 thinks about climate change. So I have three questions, and I'll put them up, and you can raise your hands. This is a somewhat whimsical survey. So first question is, do you think the globe has warmed over the last century? And no, yes, or don't know, but maybe let's look at the data. So how many think no? How many think yes? How many not sure but want to look at the data? Okay, so we're the one percenters. Okay, 1% of the people who really think that. Okay, question two. Do you think human activities will warm the globe significantly over the next century? You probably were listening to Tom, so you know what Tom thinks. So the answer is, I'll try it on you, yes. No, I don't know, but would tend to listen to the Yale Geology Department. Okay, so how many yes? How many no? How many just going to listen to the geologists?
Okay.
So there are other people you can listen to, but this is a short survey. Okay, now let's come to the economics of this. So a lot of the things Ridge talked about, he talked about fisheries, talked about forests, he talked about pollution, he talked about climate change, and all of those, if you were to ask an economist, well, say I was sleeping and you were to come in and shake me and say, fisheries, what are you going to do about fisheries? What are you going to do about climate change? I'd say, well, those are externalities, and you either tax or regulate them. Now let me go back to sleep. So it's a kind of instinctive response to something like this. These are market failures. These are places where the market is not going to be able to deal with them. If you let the market does great things. Like the computer, it's a great thing. But the market also, if it doesn't have the right signals, can send you off on the kind of dangerous things that Tom was talking about. So that's the third question. Do you think we should impose steep energy taxes to reduce CO2 and other emissions the way the economists say? Okay. Definitely not. Definitely yes. And fine as long as you don't tax me. Okay. So how many think definitely not? Okay. How many think definitely yes? And how many say fine as long as it exempts the class of 1963, which somebody could write into the law? Okay. Well, okay. So those, in a way, are the three big questions that I would want to know if I were just starting to study this subject, if I were a Yale student in the class of 2017. I would want to know. I want to study those. I would probably want to talk to the Yale Geology Department, and I want to go a little more in detail in some of those. But those are really critical questions. So that's what I want to talk about a little bit. So I'm not going to go. I had some stuff that Tom covered. I'll talk about a couple of the things. So one is about climate change is taking place. So one which is economics really, is what's happened to global CO2 emissions. So we have pretty good data on global CO2 emissions. Those get into concentrations, which get into climate change. But this is where the economy enters. Global CO2 emissions have been growing at about 2.6% since 1900. They have ups and downs. They were growing slowly in the Great Depression, and they grew relatively more rapidly in the boom after World War II. But there's been no major turning point from that 2.6% per year. That's a little slower than economic growth. Economic growth globally, as best as we can tell, is maybe something like 3.5% to 4% a year. So there's been some decarbonization. But that's basically what we're looking at. Now, two ways to slow that down. One is to have an extended economic depression, but I don't think that sounds like such a great idea. Most people would not vote for that. So we have to figure out a way to bend the curve down by bending down the intensity of the CO2 intensity of the economy, and that's what the game's about. So I'm just going to skip ahead here. Oh, I have one other thing that's an interesting. This is a variant of Tom's graph. So this is CO2 concentrations back to 800,000 minus 800,000 years, and these come from ice cores, and I don't go back before that, but these are pretty good data. So you can see what's happened over the time since humans emerged. And then those are, well, you see what's happened by 2008, which is when this graph was created. We're just about at 400, we just bip, we just passed 400 the other day. And then the emission scenarios that are built into some of the models are concentrations of between 550 and 900 parts per million. So you can see this is just a huge change in the concentrations, and things that depend critically on this are going to be heavily affected. All right. So let's go on now to, I'll say a little about impacts. I'll just give you one impact. Tom talked about some of them, but I'll give you another one which is interesting, which is hurricane damages. Now you might say, well, hurricane damages, what does that have to do with climate change? What it has to do with is that it's just fundamental physics, actually. A warmer ocean is a spawning ground for hurricanes, and not necessarily more of them, not necessarily more frequently, but pretty clearly more intense hurricanes. So that's what the physics here says, is that with the warming of the oceans, we're likely the potential upper end wind speed of a hurricane goes up. And that's what we can expect over the next 100 years. So these are actually my data. I went back and collected data going back as far as I could. And then you need a normalization. You don't want just damages. Divide them by national income or GDP. And you can see here there's an interesting rising trend over time. But it's a pretty skewed distribution. You get a lot of outliers. But it's a clear rising trend. And I'd say this is a puzzle. The economists have not figured out. I mean, we have hypotheses, but we like to actually do more than just hypothesize, and we have not figured this out. But this is something that that is on the radar screen for human societies, not talking about the bugs and so on, but for human societies over the next 100 years. There's a very dramatic picture. This has obviously been photoshopped, but it's a pretty cool picture of the Statue of Liberty during Hurricane Sandy. Okay. Now let's talk about the economics. So there are lots of different approaches, but if you listen carefully to the discussion, there are three that are mentioned a lot. One is subsidies for green technologies, subsidies for wind power, subsidies for geothermal and so on. And then there are two that are, in a sense, price strategies that are limit emissions. One is a cap and trade, which was the basis of the Kyoto Protocol in 1997, and also the basis of virtually all the proposals that have been in the U.S. Congress. And then there's a third one, which you may not have heard of, some of you probably have, but a carbon tax, and that's the brainchild of economists who don't like the cap and trade that much for technical reasons. And I'll just say a word about that. Well, I won't say too much about that. But I won't talk about subsidies. I want to just say the subsidies are not the right approach. What I'd like to do is persuade people subsidies are not a good approach. They're wasteful and they're ineffective. There's a number of studies that have been made over the last 5 years of the U.S. Subsidy, energy, and tax system. So we have all these subsidies. We have wind subsidies. We have subsidies for home insulation and so on and so forth. We have some bad subsidies as well, like the oil depletion allowance. Not bad. Well, they probably produce more greenhouse gases. And so there have been a couple of studies. What is the net effect of these green subsidies on CO2 emissions? And the answer appears to be 0 ± 1%. That basically they're doing nothing but spending money. Now, one example is ethanol, I hope none of you are in the ethanol business. Well, maybe you should be in the ethanol business. If you are, you should know about this. So ethanol seems like a no-brainer. When I first thought of ethanol, is great. Okay, ethanol, you go out there, you grow some plants which pull the CO2 out of the atmosphere, you put it through, hire some chemical engineers to figure out how to turn it into ethanol, then you blend it with gasoline, and you replace the fossil fuels. So it would seem like a no-brainer. Okay, so what are the facts on the farm? Okay, here are the facts on the farm. The facts on the farm are that if you ax CO2 emissions per mile, on the left is gasoline, so we just index it to one. So just say, on some normalized scale. From gasoline, it's one. If you go through all the things that happen when you produce and blend ethanol, it's one plus or minus about 0.2. It's basically the same. In fact, the best guess is of the people who looked at the ethanol blending subsidy was that it actually increased CO2 emissions a little tiny bit. Okay. But not within the resolution of the estimates. Why is that? Well, you need inputs to corn. You need inputs, and those have fossil fuels. You have inputs to conversion for ethanol. You have land use conversion. And then we have just a weird, weird system that I can't explain. But the way we actually do it is we have a subsidy which blend. Well, you know this. You go to the pump, it says 10% ethanol. And so you get a subsidy for mixing the ethanol with the gasoline, lowers the price of gasoline, lowers the price of the blend, increases total consumption. So you're not just increasing the production of ethanol, but you're increasing the consumption of motor fuels. You take all those together, probably increases CO2 emissions. Now, I'd say if you'd asked me 5 years ago, is ethanol a good idea or a bad idea for CO2 emission reduction? I'd say, yeah, I guess it's probably reasonable. I don't know. I'd have to study it, but sounds good to me. But actually, this is an example of a subsidy which takes money and has, let's just say, zero effect. Now, the economist's preferred approach is a carbon tax, and it's a really it has a terrible shortcoming. It's simple, okay? You can't write a 900-page bill about a carbon tax. There's a bill in the Congress that was introduced, and it was only 10 pages, and you can guess where it went. You probably have to package it together with all kinds of other things to get it through with another 890 pages. The carbon tax is really simple. You tax goods proportional to their CO2 content, and you harmonize that across industries and countries. It's a simple idea. The virtue of simplicity in this case is that it focuses your mind on what the critical element is. So it doesn't have to be a carbon tax. Maybe it could be a cap and trade that looks like a carbon tax, but it has to have the same effect on raising the price proportional to CO2 and harmonizing across industries and countries. So you can look at the EU system, which is a pretty nice system, the only working system, and you can say, well, the problem is it only covers half the emissions. So right off the bat, it's a flawed system. Well, this was the Kyoto Protocol, and the problem is, you probably know about it, it was negotiated by the Clinton administration in 1997. It went through a turbulent life. President Clinton didn't send it to Congress, then George W. Bush came in and withdrew from the treaty, and it sort of limped along, and then actually expired for all intents and purposes at the end of 2012. So there is nothing in place today. But what's interesting about it is the attrition over its lifetime. And if you take that upper graph, that shows you the share of emissions that were covered by the Kyoto Protocol. It started out about two-thirds of global emissions, and it declined over time a lot because it didn't cover developing countries, it just covered the high-income countries. And then that little drop in 2001 is when the U.S. dropped out. And then actually another little interesting thing happened when Canada, the Green Canada, you know about Green Canada? Well, not so Green Canada. They actually withdrew too because they found that they just, with their oil sands, they just couldn't make it. So this is something, this was the great hope of everybody, I suppose, in 1997, and it just died. Did anyone go to a funeral for the Kyoto Protocol? Tom, did you go? Okay. Anyway, I think it died unmourned on December 31st, 2012. Okay. I just want to say one other thing before I close. I'm left 1 second left. And that is one of the problems that all of these treaties face is what is the free riding problem. Canada's a beautiful example. When Canada pulled out of the Kyoto Protocol, nothing happened. Okay, nothing. I mean, maybe somebody scolded them, said, Canada, you're bad country. And they said, yeah, sure. But nothing happens. There's no consequences. So I think one of the things we're going to have to do going forward, this is I'd say probably something that has not been thought about a lot, is we need some sanctions for countries that don't participate. So you need something along the lines of the carbon tax, which is harmonized and for all countries. But you're also going to have sticks along with this, and you're going to have to have some way of persuading countries like Canada or the United States who are not in these that it's in their interest. And people have looked at this, say there's really only one way to do it, and that's to tie climate treaties with trade treaties, with the WTO, and actually have some kind of penalty in the framework of the World Trade Organization. I think the people are just beginning to think this through. I think I predict over the next 10 years this will become a larger set of proposals. But I also have to say that it's a dangerous idea. I mean, free and open trading system has been very valuable, and we just don't want to turn it into an open door policy for protectionism. Okay, so that wraps. That's all, folks. For me.
Okay.
I'm going to talk today about personal adventures in ecological development. Most of these activities are not of particular significance, but they're presented in the hope that they can activate each one of you to do something about those changes that are so necessary to cause the shift in our human behavior that's going to ensure the survival of the planet and humanity. So, are we started? Okay, let's start the PowerPoint. I take it personally. No, wait, from the beginning, please. Whoa. From the beginning, every 6 seconds.
All right, hang on, I'll start it over. Sorry.
I can't talk that fast.
We do environment, but we're not technical whizzes.
I was afraid this might happen. Okay, can we start? It's personal. That's my house. These are the fish I used to see in the waves. I used to try to count them. They're no more. The fish are gone. You're talking about where the fish, they're actually gone in front of my home in Hawaii. The coral where I used to dive, it's gone too. You talk about rising seas. These rocks were never underwater when I was a kid. Now they are. The ocean is rising. Kind of like Sarah Palin, I can see the enemy from my house. That's Mauna Loa in the background where they measure it. Al Gore says we need an international consensus of nation states. I'm a shoeless Hawaiian. I'm not a nation state. So what can we do about all of this? A Scotsman, Patrick Geddes, talked about the idea of thinking global but acting locally, which we can do. And maybe we can actuate the Lorenz attractor, which you all know about, right? There it is. All of my adventures are for profit. Some were fun. Some made a difference. And a lot of them were in red states. And they gave me a great deal of pleasure, both physically and metaphysically. About a bit about my background. I'm from Hawaii. I think that's important. Our state motto, Uamau ke'e oka'aina I ka pono. The life of the land relies on pono. Right thinking, right doing, right speaking, right being. Aina, the word aina, is about
food, sex, survival, and na is the plural. Mohalla is not is a to make visible, to allow the to unburden like a flower. Here's my house in Hawaii. You want a house? Put it on a truck and truck it someplace. You want a house? Cut up a bridge and build it. That's sustainable development. We didn't have a grid. We collected the water from the roof, icebox for refrigerator, light for coma. So the sustainable features, we knew about this in the 40s. All of you did. So did we. Here's my first adventure. I was a housing guy. I thought about water. So I bought 6 acres in Malibu. Half of our water comes from the Sierras. All of it comes from the Sierras. Half is for landscaping. Half goes through the into the sewers. It's treated. It's allowed to overflow, and it goes in the ocean, and it destroys the ecosystem. We create evapotranspiration. It's taken up from the ground into the plants. Now about a lot of the people are thinking about using that. Here is a Sun Valley, Idaho, a half a mile of the river, a housing development. Put drop structures in the river, back it up, create a bike path, and we coalesced everybody in the county to create a new riparian area. This is the place I first fly fished. This is that's my housing development today. You can go up there and fly fish. That's a drop structure. National parks, here's a deal we did in LA. That's our park. You can see up to the left, that's LA. You can see LA in the middle. This is a close-up of our park, 1,900 acres of land that is adjacent to Malibu, 5 miles of coastline. These are my friends that did it and how we did it. Here are some local inhabitants that you can meet in that park. You've heard about the Sierra Club. We support the grizzlies and the wolves, right? In California, we shot the last one in 1922. Parks are for people, but what about endangered species? There's no place for them. My friends in Riverside took the whole county and they created the multi-species habitat conservation plan, 1.2 million acres of land, 146 species, and then they created linkages to allow the wildlife to all link up. We're currently working on an 8,000-acre project, 57 species, 8% of the acquisition. I also work in nonprofits, and we lead and we teach. In SciArc, we decided to move to downtown LA, ground zero for homelessness. This was a site adjacent to the river. It was great for the Native Americans and the Pueblos. And here's the LA River today. We decided to revitalize this railroad station. Today, it's the heart of the LA district. Property values have sextupled. SciArc's number one in the world in robotics, and number two in design. We also teach. I teach a course called Unnatural Acts. My pedagogy is based on Ian McHarg's book, Design with Nature. If you haven't read it, please do. He's a wonderful guy. Great Scotsman. And here's one of our projects, the Kauai Ahupua'a, 10,000 acres in the island. $1 billion worth of sandalwood was harvested. Today it's rented for $50,000 a year. We had a planning exercise at SciArc, where we did all of these things. And then we were hired to go to Molokai to oppose a development of the last 19 miles of sea line. We solved for the exit value to give them the same amount of money that they wanted to do originally. They didn't take our deal, but the folks, I'm going to move on here. Here's our trade winds, fast response pump hydro. We got kicked out by the local utility, but then we put up one little windmill that was subsidized by $65,000. We'll save about $2.5 million a year. We got the mayor and the governor, and they said, you know what, that's a great idea. So we're back to the Kauai High Ahupua'a, and we're going to do that on this site. Here's the Kohala Center, where we work. Energy, ecology, education, and economics. One idea, school gardens teach kids to grow stuff, and their parents learn how to eat it. Nation states at work. This is the endangered sea turtle in my lagoon in front of my house. I haven't seen a monk seal in 70 years. This guy came into my place. That's my grandson. That's the Lorenza tractor. You'll know it from a different name. The butterfly effect. Each of you can do this. It's a lot of fun. Ho'o mahalo pono. Aloha.
Thank you, Ian. And now it's open up to everybody for participation. We have two speakers down here just so that people can hear your questions. So if you have a question or a comment, anything you'd like to say on anything we've touched or perhaps something we haven't had a chance to talk about, please come on down and use the mics. It's open season.
Can anybody comment about the Brazilian experience with ethanol made from sugarcane? It's more efficient produce, and they're what, 100% ethanol in their automobiles? And do you know more about it?
So the point is that this doesn't have to be this way, and the Brazilian experience has been quite different, but they have a completely different process because they use sugar cane, and we're using primarily corn. And people have been trying to get us to move off of corn into some advanced cellulosic ethanol, and we're just not there yet.
I would just add to that, it's also tropical sun, so you get about 8 times the amount of ethanol per acre or whatever.
I think my favorite argument that bears on economics and on world trade is that the United States exports most of its manufacturing to China and then blames China for exceeding its quota of CO2 emissions, a lot of which they're doing by making products for us. Now, how do we suitably assign the blame and assign the cost for that?
That's a Bill question.
That's an interesting point. So linking a trade treaty and a climate treaty is that it's a way of inducing people to join up to the club. So the way this actually, I'll tell you, the inspiration of this was a pretty simple idea. I was looking at Greece, and Greece was going through the terrible problems it's going through. And why in the world would you want to go through, we want to go through what Greece is going through, a depression, just the social distress, the high unemployment. And the answer was, well, they're the member of a club that's worth being in. So being a member of this free trade arrangement plus everything else that's in the European Union and the Eurozone is worth it to Greece. And so they're slogging it through. So my thought is, well, okay, we have what is close to a free trade agreement among countries right now. And so if you want to be part of that agreement, like Greece wants to be a member of the EU, then you have to meet your responsibility with respect to the global environment as well. And so once you're in the club, then it's basically the same, would be the same trade agreements as you have, the same trade rules as you have now. This would not involve trying to tax the CO2 content of imports and exports. That's just a fruitless endeavor.
Just one additional comment on the China aspect. As many of you know, China brings a new coal-fired power plant online about once every week, and India is not far behind. And so many in this country say, you know, why should we do anything? It's just going to be overwhelmed by the contributions of CO2 to the atmosphere from those countries. They say the same thing about us. If the United States, who's been the biggest CO2 emission per capita country for a long time, isn't going to take leadership, why should we do anything? So, you know, we haven't talked too much here about the political or international implications of doing something, but it does seem to me that instead of the two of us seeing how little we can do, there's a lot to be said for getting together and seeing if we can't together do more. And I do think in this country there are opportunities to let our public officials know about this. As many of you know, during the first couple of years of the Obama administration, when there was a Democratic Senate and Congress, the House did pass a cap-and-trade bill. It died in the Senate, and when the congressional mix switched, it looked as though that was out. There seems to be periodically support for a bill, what Bill mentioned briefly, the carbon tax, which has a lot of efficiency on it. And for a while, it was thought that even Republicans, who generally are not as enthusiastic about Democrats for legislation that would reduce carbon emissions, might say, here's a way to help reduce the deficit. Instead of taxing things that we currently tax and that the Obama administration might want to tax more of, let's have a carbon tax. I don't think that got much traction, Bill, to the best of my knowledge. And I think some people even suggested, well, suppose we call it a fee. Take it out from under Grover Norquist's pledge. We'll call this a fee for people who want to use our common atmosphere. Maybe it gets more political traction. I don't know whether any of the panelists or any of you out in the rest of the auditorium have thoughts on that. But it seems to me that we need to take a little more leadership than the abysmal lack thereof that we're showing now politically. I'll just add, I was having a conversation with Carlisle Hall over lunch, and California, as you know, has a cap-and-trade program. And before it was passed, businessmen made the same allegations that you hear from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the petroleum industry. And for those of you who don't know Washington, and you're not missing a hell of a lot by not being there, if the Chamber of Commerce and the petroleum and the coal industries don't want controls on CO2 emissions, it's very hard to get them done. People said of California before that law passed, business is going to move out. It'll be an economic disaster. Well, in fact, businesses haven't moved out, and California's got a surplus. So there's hope. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I tried to listen to the presentations as though I were a graduate in 2013 here and say, gee, each of you guys list some trends that are pretty dramatic, and they're awful, actually, for me and my generation. I wonder if we're going to survive. And I wonder, what do you guys think will be a precipitating event to cause the Chinese to stop complaining about the Americans to stop complaining about the Indians and the Chinese? Where are we going to find the common ground and realize it really is a matter of sort of survival as opposed to interesting abstract ideas? Ain't it awful?
If you want to take a crack at that?
Well, I guess what we all hope for is not having to wait for something that's so calamitous that it just sort of triggers, you know, an immediate response after a long, long wait. So I think there is some good news here if you look at public opinion polls about attitudes in this country, which are being done jointly by a group up at the Forestry School and a group at George Mason, where I am. And you can see a building awareness and concern and eagerness to do something about climate change.
I would think also that we see throughout our country and indeed the world, we see and especially with our kids, a growing appreciation of the problem. We've seen the greening of Yale, but more particularly, the world sustainable development of the term really wasn't created until 1987, and all of a sudden we have this awareness and we're struggling through ideas about how to do it. Do we really want to change the way we live our lives? What's it going to do to our jobs, to our family, and so on and so forth? But I think worldwide we're coming to a realization that there's a better way to do things. And I see a tremendous acceleration really on a local activity that is making a difference.
Let me take a shot at that. So I think that's a really good question. I actually don't, I don't think there's going to be any great precipitating event. I think it's going to be more like, I'm hoping, it'll be more like what happened to smoking, that people gradually learned, they began to accept the science, they saw the presentations, they saw what was happening around them, they saw sea level rise, they saw hurricanes, they saw what was happening to glaciers around the world. They found that the people who are trying to shoot this down just look idiotic. They don't have convincing cases when they're trying to argue that this is just a hoax. So I think that's part of it. I think there's just no substitute for continuing to push this, to investigate the science, to hear what people like Tom have to say, the climatologists, glaciologists, just to hear the message again and again. You might say, oh, I've heard that so many times, but you know, it's a little different because every week something new, if you pick up science or nature, there's some new thing. And Tom talked about the acidification of the ocean. I remember the first time I heard a presentation was not the first time, but one of the really vivid presentations was one Tom made, and it was just a brilliant presentation. And I said, oh my God, another thing I didn't know about is going to be happening. So I think that's one thing. A second thing is we do have to make a technological transition. We are hooked on fossil fuels now. 80% of our energy system is on, and we're going to have to find a way either to clean them up or to get off them. And that's hard, and it's going to take more science and technology and engineering, and it's going to take the support. And it's one of the reasons we need a federal government, because those are the kinds of things that are not going to be supported by businesses because they have such long time payouts and big and diffuse rewards. And then the third thing, which is just something I emphasize, I think we need a low-cost and effective strategy to deal with it, and that's why I emphasize the carbon tax. All the studies suggest that if you were to put on, let's say, $25 a ton carbon tax, and not to waste the revenues, but to, say, recycle the revenues, or use them to support important government programs, that the cost to the economy of that is really small. I mean, like a quarter of a percent of income. It's just a tiny little number if it's done right. And one of the reasons I like it is, I think, I'm not a conservative, but I think if I were a conservative, I would love it. You can get rid of all these regulations. You can get rid of all these subsidies. You can get rid of all these things that are doing this in a kind of backwards and indirect way. You just do it. You just do it with a tax. It's much more efficient. It's much cleaner. And it's like a surgeon who's going right to, instead of like futzing around with your knee and your leg and your neck and everything, it's just going right to where the problem is. And one other thing, just one final point. Governments around the world need revenues. I mean, we are an aging society. Our healthcare expenditures are going up. And we're not the only one. Virtually every country in the world, they need revenues. And this is a good source of revenue. It's a good, and as I think Ridge mentioned, I like it because it's taxing bads rather than goods. It's not taxing capital and labor and other things that are useful. It's taxing something that is harmful. So I think, so that's one of the messages I would put. This is, it's hard to think of anything that is a kind of a better, solid public policy proposal than a carbon tax. I think it solves a lot of problems just, you know, with one blow. So that's one of the reasons I think I emphasize that.
Another note of encouragement very briefly is that on the island of Hawaii, we have already reached 32% of our electrical generation is fossil fuel free, and one of the things that we wanted to do with our wind energy experiment was to get to 100%, which we could have done. But I think we will get there, whether it's through wind or through geothermal or through solar or through new kinds of technologies that are coming on, we see that it is doable and we can get there in various ways, and people are beginning to say, that's a really good idea. And in fact, when I pay 42 cents a kilowatt hour for my house in Hawaii for energy, and the ranch where we put that silly little windmill up has zero energy costs for the next 30 years, the governor woke up and the mayor woke up and he said, let's do it. So these kinds of things, I think, are happening, and I think they're happening pretty quickly. And I would agree with Bill about the carbon tax, although in wind and solar, the subsidies have brought wind costs down from about 32 cents a kilowatt hour to about 8.5 cents a kilowatt hour. So in a sense, they did work, but carbon tax is probably better.
Peter?
Yeah, I'd like to get the panel's idea about what individual members, I mean, what can we do? You know, it's not changing fluorescent light bulbs, right? What can individual people in the class of 1963 do to address this problem?
Whatever really energizes you, because it all helps, because you get out in the community and you start working and you start creating a little nexus of friends that turns into larger things. And over and over and over again, whether it's whether it is teaching a course that eventually leads to enrolling the governor and the state and the mayor, or whatever it does, doing a project that gets people that are excited about doing something that you know in your heart of hearts advances the ball a little bit, that's really important, because the nation states have got to do things, but they need this political support of all of us working on the local level with our friends to get our congressmen and our representatives elected. And that's the point of what I do, which is you don't have to wear a hair shirt. You can engage in for-profit activity, and you can make it fun, and you can make a difference. And you can see maybe next year, 5 years, sometimes it's 10 years on, that little activities that you did have really a much wider impact. So, you know, just get going.
That's one of the bright stories, I think, around the country, is that there are a number of communities where people are, you've all heard the phrase, think globally, act locally. In the Chesapeake region, for example, where I work, the effort to clean up the bay has generated a whole lot of private initiatives. For example, the mayor and a group of businesses in Baltimore said, you know, Baltimore Harbor is a stinking mess. Let's clean it up. So Constellation Energy, Legg Mason, and a bunch of individuals who live in the area got together, created some money. They're cleaning it up. They're going to have a triathlon there in 2 years. The swimming event is going to be right through Baltimore Harbor. There are individuals and citizens groups engaged in stream revegetation, removing invasive species, cleaning up trash. And there are a lot of mayors who are providing incentives for smart growth. In Washington, D.C., you cannot build a new building that's not LEED certified anymore. Washington, D.C. has the highest per capita green roof population of every city, but I think it's either New York or Chicago, one or the other of those. But there are a lot of initiatives, and, you know, I think the good news is all of this stuff does make a difference, and it's worth doing.
Can I just say one thing on that?
Yeah. Okay.
So every once in a while I get depressed about this and say, oh, you know, nothing's happening, and the people are so stubborn and pig-headed and wooden-headed. So I went to talk to my colleague of mine, David Mayhew, who's a very distinguished political scientist, and I was moaning and saying, oh, he says, just relax. He says, we always underestimate the way politicians can change their minds overnight. If the wind starts blowing in the right direction and it looks like it's advantageous, then you could find a group of people which had been dead against this 5 years ago gradually change.
So I think if I what I would say is, those of you who think this is important, find people who disagree with you and talk to them, and try to reason it out and see if there can be some common ground. Because I think the real hope is that as we talk it over and as we find common ground, that we will see that it's actually a solvable problem. It's not an impossible problem.
What did Winston say about that? You can always trust the American people to do the right thing after they've exhausted every other possibility?
Winston Churchill.
So, but there is an important point here, which is, I think, in what everybody's been saying, which is this is not gloom and doom. It's actually place where there's considerable opportunity, and if we can unleash the forces of human creativity, we can make a huge difference.
Got a couple more questions.
I agree, I guess, with some of what you're saying, but I think there's something that's missing, and maybe Tom would have a cogent comment or response to this. Biologic systems fail catastrophically. That's true at a species level, it's true at an organ level in humans, it's true at an organ level in virtually every biologic system you look at. And we're talking about failure. I mean, the threat is the failure of the biologic system that we call Earth. And it's very nice that all these initiatives are happening. It's very nice that, Ian's being so great on Hawaii and the state is responding, so on and so forth. But the question is, where are we? I'll give you an example. For instance, as you probably know, you can whack out a kidney and nothing much happens. You know, your health is fine. You can whack out pretty much half of the other kidney and nothing much happens. Take 2% more, and you go into renal failure and you die. That's the way biologic systems work. All of them. And the question is, where are we on the continuum of that? How close are we, in somebody like Tom's opinion, to being at the precipitous point of that catastrophic system? Because if we're there, or if we're too close, screwing around with all these little things that you guys are talking about are not going to do the job. And if so, if that's what the scientific community thinks, then we should be, I guess, more active about it. So I'd welcome Tom.
Well, let me give you a somewhat discursive answer to that. I basically came to the conclusion, looking at what's already happening with coniferous forests, with flickers of dieback in the Amazon, what's happening with tropical coral reefs, I come to the conclusion that 2 degrees is too much. And that the 2-degree goal has to be revisited. It was mostly chosen because it seemed to be something you could get to. And, you know, there will be those who look at emission rates and everything else and just say that's a hopeless thing to do. Well, I don't think it has to be a hopeless thing to do. I mean, first of all, there is half a degree that you can take out of what we're committed to through that, what I talked about. And we need to find really cheap ways to pull CO2 out of the atmosphere. I mean, it's almost economic now in chimneys, but it's much more concentrated there. So we just need to think on a bigger scale and get more creative minds into coming up with these things.
I think Tom is absolutely right, and I've worried a lot that because people can't see global warming, or they say, well, so what? If the planet warms up a degree or two, that's not so bad. It's not like the fish kills that inspired the Clean Water Act or the heavily polluted skies over Pittsburgh that inspired the Clean Air Act. But if we don't do something based on the information we've got, you know, our grandchildren are likely to look back with a very damaged planet and say, what the hell were they thinking? They had the evidence. Why didn't they do more? It sounds naive. I think people should write their senators and congressmen and let them know that this is important. Do it. Be as active as you can. And we've got time for one more question.
And since I'm the only person who raised this hand about not raising taxes, CO2 taxes, I have a double-edged question. One is I think that Bill's comments about technology and the failure of the ethanol technology and discrediting the entire industry, I think is wrong, because I think the only way we're going to have a solution is by employing techniques of new technologies that are going to get people interested in making money across the entire spectrum of the globe, not just the United States, because it involves the entire globe. And that's the only way, if people think they're going to make money, that they're going to be able to have new technologies that may make a difference. And if the ethanol system didn't work, then you have to find a way to make it work, not just say not doing these new technologies and just raise taxes. Does Bill or any of you have any information? Taxes have been going up on cigarettes for the last 40 years, and they're gigantic now in terms of the cost of cigarettes. How much of an impact has raising taxes gigantically on cigarettes made a difference in cigarette consumption as a parallel to carbon dioxide manufacture in the United States? Smoking cigarettes was undesirable. We wanted people to stop smoking cigarettes, so we raised the taxes on cigarettes. We used that money to help people who have skin cancer and for cancer prevention and for methodologies of treating skin cancer, of treating lung cancer. So how much of an impact is that, as an example, made when you're using taxes on CO2 emissions as a parallel to that? Did it really make a difference in cigarettes, or was that just a change in people's attitudes that made a difference in cigarettes? And why on earth do you think that raising a tax on carbon dioxide emissions is going to change anybody's minds? They're just going to charge more.
Very briefly, because I know we're out of time here and out of town. I actually think cigarettes is a complicated subject. It involves addictions and other kinds of issues. The place we have a really good reading is on gasoline taxes, where we have huge differences in gasoline taxes and gasoline prices across different countries. And you can read in the data that both over time and over space, the big differences in gasoline consumption per capita. Now, you can argue causality, but it's pretty persuasive. Now, I just want to come back to your first point, though, which is a really important one. I think one of the important reasons to get the price of emissions up is because it will spur innovation. So if you think of some of these things that Tom was talking about, let's say windmills that take CO2 out of the air, why am I going to spend any money to take CO2 out of the air if the CO2 price is zero? But if the price of that rises higher and higher, and then that is going to be a spur for the private sector, for for-profit companies, for the Exxons and the GEs of this world to start thinking about what kinds of technologies can be low CO2 technologies. So I actually think, in a way, that's not an argument I often use, but I think it's the most powerful argument, is that over the long run, to get the price of CO2 up, whether by taxes or cap and trade, is the most powerful spur, because it's going to promote low CO2 technologies in a kind of even way across many, many industries.
We're out of time. I thank you very much for your attendance and your participation. Thanks.